You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Today, it's a warm welcome back to author and researcher Denver Michaels. Denver and his wife are currently indulging in one of those fantasies most of us have, being able to sell up and travel around the US in their RV. Denver updates us on some of the locations he's managed to visit so far, including Roswell and Hopkinsville, hunting for petroglyphs in several states, a visit to a haunted bridge, and we also discuss Denver's encounter with a road ghost that will leave you in no doubt about what he experienced that night. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, competitions, and more. You can also sign up in the link in the show notes as always. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms: Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, Mastodon, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now it's time to hit the road as we welcome back Denver Michaels for a long overdue return. On today's show, it's a long overdue welcome back to Denver Michaels, author and researcher. Denver has had a lifelong interest in all aspects of the strange, the weird, and the unusual. Formerly based in Virginia, Denver is now travelling across the USA with his wife, making me extremely jealous and envious of his adventures on the road. Denver, welcome back.
Hey, man, it's good to be back. I appreciate you having me.
I know, it's one of those things, Denver, that I sometimes sit down and I look at the shows I've recorded and I think, I really would love to speak to that person again. And then I sit down and realize it's been 3.5 years. So my sincere apologies.
Well, hey, man, I guess it probably has been 3.5 years, but you know, it's like, it's talking about this the other day. It's like the older I get, you know, 3.5 years seems like 6 months ago. So it doesn't really seem like it's been that long ago since you and I talked. So, no need to apologize there.
Absolutely. You were one of my first interviews, Denver, back in the old days. So it's lovely to finally have a catch up with you. And there's so much changed for all of us, I think, over that period of time. But as I mentioned in the introduction, since we last spoke, you have taken on an incredible undertaking, really, I think, because it's always a dream that people have all around the world, I think, that they can just sell up, pack up, and just hit the road and just go wherever the roads will lead them to. So for someone like you who has spent near enough their entire life based in your home state of Virginia, Denver, what on earth was the catalyst that made you think, to hell with this, we're out?
Well, you know, it was a long time coming, and I don't know if it's just that I finally lost my mind for what it was, but yeah, like the wife and I, we've always loved to travel, and you know, it's been something that you know, since we've been together, we've always really placed a strong emphasis on traveling as much as we can. You know, getting those experiences. There's nothing like travel, you know, as far as learning things, you know, just the experience of it. And I really don't know where these conversations started, but, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, my wife kind of started prodding me like, you know, what if we, just started traveling around in an RV? And I'm just kind of like, yeah, honey, whatever. But, you know, as time went on, at the time, our youngest daughter, she enlisted in the Air Force, you know, so she was out of the house, self-sufficient. Our other two, they were both in college, but almost done, you know. So I don't really know where we kind of come to the agreement on this. And I know there were a lot of conversations, but at some point we just kind of mutually decided during this sitting in traffic and all this, and it's screw having this house to take care of. As soon as we can get these kids, get the latest tuition payment paid on their college, we just kind of said, that's it. We're just going to quit our 9-to-5 job, sell the house. And we did. And pretty much everything that wasn't nailed down, we sold it. I mean, like, we sold everything. I've got a couple of toolboxes over at my mom's house and, you know, like a tub full of keepsakes for my wife.
Yeah.
And other than that, I mean, I just don't even have any material possessions anymore. But you know, we did it, and we've been living on the road. The wife actually was able to land, I guess you could call it a 9-to-5 job that's, you know, completely remote. So, you know, it's not like we're out here destitute or anything. But we did that. Took off in September full time, and we've been enjoying it, man. We really love it.
Yeah, I suppose in regards to your wife's employment status, Deborah, what's happened to everybody over the last couple of years has really freed a lot of people up to not be tethered to desks and the normal 9-to-5 grind. You can work remotely for a lot of people, and for a lot of us that have worked in that kind of environment, I think many of us have a wry smile about all those conversations we used to have over the previous 20 years where they were simply telling us, oh, you can't do this from home. You're going to have to come into the office all the time.
Yeah, it really has liberated a lot of people. And I don't know. I think it's kind of, you know, opened a lot of people's eyes too, as far as kind of like prioritizing things in life. You know, I mean, there are a lot of... We're not necessarily tied to the traditional way of doing things, you know, like 9-to-5 or 8-to-5 with a forced unpaid 1 hour of lunch, and you know, sitting in traffic for an hour each way to work. You know, I think a lot of people have started like, there's got to be a better way to live than what we've all been doing. And you know, I'm certainly not suggesting everybody out there quit their good paying job and sell their house and everything they own like I did. But, you know, I think there's probably a happy medium out there for some people. There probably is a way to, you know, travel a little bit more and kind of experience life in different ways than the way we've all been told we have to live.
Mm-hmm. I suppose one of the biggest problems, Denver, when you made this decision a couple of years ago and what you were going to do is, where were you going to go first? So was this a mutual conversation that you had due to your love of the weird and the wonderful? Because I know your partner doesn't share your obsessions.
She kind of humors me with it, but like really she couldn't care less about Bigfoot and gobblers and all of that stuff. So. I guess so. Our first part of the journey, I guess, we kind of plan everything around like really sort of what the weather's going to be like, right? Like right now I'm in Yuma, Arizona, and the weather's amazing. It's 70, 73 degrees, gets down to, you know, like on a cold night, it might get down to 40. But you don't want to be here in May because it's like 120, you know, and it's just brutal. So you kind of have to plan things like where you're going as far as, you know, how the weather is, that sort of thing. And like on our first leg, it was September when we took off. So we knew we wanted to go down to Florida from where we were for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we went over into Kentucky and Tennessee, kind of saw some places there that I'd wanted to, like one of the first, like in the opening weeks, we went to a couple of cool places in Kentucky. We went to the Mammoth Caves, which is something I'd always wanted to do. Unfortunately, COVID was in full swing then. So, you know, only a certain section of caves were open. So I wasn't really able to explore them, you know, as much as I wanted to, but I was still able to go into one of the main sections of the cave. So I was able to do that. And on the way there, I was able to visit the little town of Hopkinsville, Kentucky. A lot of your listeners, I'm sure, might be familiar with the, what was it, 1955, the Hopkinsville Goblins, where a family had like, for lack of a better word, like a shootout that kind of lasted all night with little green men. So I was able to go to that town. It was kind of cool to, you know, where the incident took place was on private property, but about a quarter mile from there in the town, they sort of pay tribute to it. There's like a, you know, like a community park, and they got like this giant UFO. I mean, it's like huge. And they, you know, they've got a little, a couple little signs and things like that. And at the time, I think because of COVID, they had canceled it, but, I don't know if they've resumed it since, but they used to do like a little festival there in honor of the, of that case. So I was able to see that, and this was like in the opening weeks, after we, started traveling full time. So I think I kind of kicked it off right.
Absolutely. You've set yourself a high bar from that point onwards, Denver, I would suggest. So, I mean, when you go to somewhere like Hopkinsville, as you say, for anybody that has a love of the strange or UFOs or alien, Hopkinsville is a case that is one of the weirdest, I think, in the modern era because of what happened and how it happened and the people that were involved. And there's all kinds of spurious accusations made towards this poor family who went through this incident that particular evening. When you go somewhere like that, Denver, under normal circumstances, because obviously, as I touched on in the introduction, you are a man that has released numerous books. I think you're into double figures now. You've been writing for a considerably long time about weird and wonderful things. So for you as both a lover of the strange and an author, was it sort of something that had really sort of been close to your heart all your life that you needed to get to somewhere like this, as you say, within the first few weeks of hitting the road?
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things that's real important to me as a writer, and you know, you're not always able to do this, but if it's at all possible when I'm writing a book, I mean, I like to visit these places that I write about, you know, I like to get my boots on the ground. I like to be there in person. I like to take original photographs. It's just important to me, you know, to see places firsthand. Now you can't always do that. I mean, there's limitations, for money, for being able to, you know, to get to some places. I mean, for instance, if I write about the moon one day, well, I'm not going to be able to go to the moon, obviously, but you know, any place that is reasonable that I can reasonably afford to get to or within driving distance, I really want to see as many places as I can for myself. Now, I'm not really adding anything to the conversation like Hopkinsville, right? I mean, that happened in 1955. So me being there, yeah, I didn't uncover any new information. Okay. I just didn't. But you know, I don't know. It's like when you're able to visit a place, you know, even if you can't uncover anything new or, you know, really even learn anything that you didn't already know, I think it just kind of builds a little bit more of a connection, you know, within yourself. And now I don't really know if I'm saying that quite right or explaining it well, but I just really enjoy being in places that I write about firsthand. It just I don't know. It's just important to me to try to do that as much as I'm able.
Hmm. I think as someone that's done similar things over here in the UK, Denver, I just think, even as you say, even if I'm just going there to tick something off my personal bucket list, or I'm not particularly going to be researching anything or looking to interview anybody, I think it is important to go there because it does give you a sense of the place, of the town, of the people, of the environment. Because obviously Hopkinsville is quite close to the southern edge of Kentucky as well. It's, you know, it's near enough in Tennessee. It's not that far away from Nashville. So it's interesting for people like me who haven't had the opportunity to visit these states in sort of mid-America, where they are so large, and you can really take a depth of the people around them and how the whole state changes depending on which direction you go and where it's near enough to. So I completely understand what you're saying, because I think being somewhere like that gives you a bit more, there's a bit more meat on the bones of the story, I think, when you can have a walk around. And even if you can't get on the property, as you mentioned there about the house that happened at Hopkinsville, I think just being in the vicinity of it is enough often.
Yeah, I think so too. And if I could go back a little bit, you made a great point about how within a state, how things change just within the direction you go. I can't stress that enough. And especially, you know, here in the U.S., like for your U.K. listeners, like how big a lot of our states are and places in the U.S. are. Like, for instance, if I'm in Texas, and if I'm in El Paso, Texas, so, you know, on the border of Mexico, out in like as far west in Texas as you can go. A lot of people don't realize this, but I can drive to Los Angeles as quick, maybe even a little bit quicker, than I can drive to Houston, you know, which is in the same state.
Yeah.
You know, that just kind of, I think that kind of gives you a little bit of perspective on that. And so you can imagine, I mean, how many in a place as large as Texas, you know, people in El Paso are totally different than people up in Amarillo in the Panhandle, or people in Houston out to the east. And even in my home state of Virginia, which is much smaller than Texas or these western states, you know, just really an average or below average size state. There are so many, there's so many different regions within that small state. Like down in southwestern Virginia, where I'm from, there's mountains, there's coal mines. But out toward the east, there's ocean, and to the north, you know, you've got the District of Columbia suburb. So it's really built up and high tech. And in between all those points, you know, you got the tobacco farms and the Piedmont and horse farms. And so, and all of these different regions are distinct in how people, what am I trying to say? You know, foods, the people's accents.
Yeah.
I mean, in Virginia, you got just like a whole array of different accents. And so all of these, uniqueness within each state is really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, the UK, the whole of the UK can fit in 11 American states. There are,
yeah.
So, you know, I think often, you know, we like to think we're very important, Denver. And then sometimes I like to remember the fact that keeps my feet on the ground. Certainly, you know, I think something like 7.5 times the UK would fit in Alaska. So, and then you look how many people live in Alaska and you think, hey, there's a lot of space there for strange things to go on. So I love some of these states and these little nuances. I remember speaking to somebody once who was telling me about how long it takes to drive down the length of California. And I said, well, you could probably drive to one end of the UK and back.
Yeah,
you know, and go through three countries, whereas there you're just going down the coast.
Yeah, I mean, California is huge. Yeah, it would probably, I bet you'd take, I've not drove it yet. Me and the wife plan to here in the upcoming year, but I bet you'd probably take about 10 or 11 hours to drive the length of California. Just thinking about it off the top of my head. I mean, it's huge. It's huge. And you, like in California, you can be up in the mountains skiing, and a few hours later, you could be down on the beach swimming, right? And then, a few hours from there, you could be out in the middle of the desert. It's just crazy, the varying landscapes just in that one state.
Absolutely. I would imagine as well, I know you said you and your wife have always enjoyed traveling, but I would imagine as well, when you've been able to go to some of these states that you might have only passed through or gone to specific cities in them, Denver in the past, when you get to these kind of places, you can appreciate the scenery and the landscape more, because as you say, there are so many states in the US where I think people think it's all everybody thinks Texas is a desert, but it's clearly not. Massive portion of it's quite wet and swampy on the eastern side of it as it goes across towards the more southern states that have that kind of reputation, like Tennessee and Alabama and such like. Whereas, as you say there, California, you've got such a range of tropical changes that you can, as you say, you could probably ski to the beach if you get your route correctly. So has that given you an appreciation of some of these states that you'd never had a real chance to kind of really get stuck into and get your boots on the ground out there?
Oh, absolutely. And this is something the wife and I mean, we talk about it all the time. Like, I'm trying to think of a specific example, right? But, so we're out in places that like in the middle of New Mexico or Arizona. And, if we weren't specifically RVing and pursuing this lifestyle, we would have never been to this town or this amazing place with these beautiful views, because we're 5 hours from any decent sized airport in any direction. So when you're not RVing like this and going slow, staying in just some random place for a week, you just don't get to see the things that we get to see now. And that's been one of the greatest parts of doing this. We're seeing places in America that it just nobody gets to see. And that's been the most rewarding thing of all, I think.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things, Deborah. I've always found this a very unfair criticism of Americans, that people say, oh, well, they don't travel abroad. And I often think, well, do you appreciate just how varied America is? Because, you could go all the way up to the north, to states like Michigan and Illinois, and you can go all the way to the south, and you've got states like New Mexico and Texas, which are essentially like different countries anyway. They are so wildly different that I think sometimes people... I think it's a very unfair criticism of Americans. Because to be fair, if I lived in the States, there's not many places that would tempt me to leave the continent of North America. If I'm brutally honest, Denver, I'd be looking at flying over to California or down to Florida again, or getting stuck into some of those swampy states on the south, rather than sort of sitting on an airplane for 14 hours to get to Italy or something. So I think it's one of those things that I think people really need to appreciate just how varied some states are, because they are vastly different. When you come from Virginia, is nothing like anything you would encounter in the Southeast, is it?
No, it's like where I was living out in the Shenandoah Valley. I mean, it is. It's a completely different country than like a place in the Florida Panhandle, which is almost completely a different country compared to South Florida. We talked about the different places in Texas, New Mexico. I mean, like, for instance, this is something me and my wife kind of learned recently. We're traveling around Arizona, New Mexico, And I guess because the time of year we traveled before, we didn't realize it. But I mean, there's like huge cotton fields out here. I mean, huge cotton fields, like as far as the eye can see. And, you know, we just looked at each other and like, I didn't even know they grew cotton in Arizona. Cause you know, you think of the deep South, you know, you think of Alabama or East Texas, Mississippi. And I mean, I had no idea they grew cotton in New Mexico and Arizona. I mean, I don't know why I didn't know it, but I didn't know it. And I never would have figured that out if I wasn't out here traveling.
I think the other aspect of this, as we touched on, your love of the weird, and for many people who listen to this program, Denver, towns like Hopkinsville, we all know Hopkinsville and where it is because of what happened there. It's one of those wonderful things about so many of these little places dotted around the US, as you say, that you've now got an opportunity to tick these off your mystery bucket list as you travel around. Whereas for a lot of us, the dream of going to somewhere like Van Meter or Point Pleasant, for anybody outside of the US, is almost an impossible dream, it would seem, unless we're fortunate enough to drop on an opportunity to get there. So when you hear about these towns like Hopkinsville have embraced their legacy, as it were, in the weird, I think that's one of the things that often gets overlooked when we talk about legends and encounters and these kind of stories, Denver, because for a lot of these towns, nobody outside of their state would ever have visited that place if it wasn't for what happened there.
Oh, I mean, you're exactly right. And I'd written a little piece on my website after I'd visited Hopkinsville. And I said this, and I didn't mean it in a negative way, but, you know, like a bunch of people kind of got butthurt over it. I said, you know, I kind of introduced like, yeah, I went to Hopkinsville, population 39,000 or whatever it is. It's probably not even that much. And I just said this little sentence. I'm like, there's no real reason to visit Hopkinsville, right? And I mean, man, people on Twitter were just like killing me. They're like, oh, there's tons of reasons to visit. And, you know, I wasn't trying to say anything negative, but like, if we're being honest, there would be no reason for me to have driven from Stevens City, Virginia, you know, 10 or 11 hours to Hopkinsville, Kentucky, if it weren't for those goblins, right? Or if I weren't RVing and passing through.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Maybe they got a couple of cool bars, or there's a great little restaurant. But I mean, come on, like if we're being honest, and I'm not putting down your town, guys, I'm just trying to make a point here. And that's what I was trying to say. But man, people get sensitive about their towns. So, but yeah, I mean, the point is like, if it weren't for the Mothman, like nobody would even know about Point Pleasant. I mean, you just would. It's just a random town, you know, on the Ohio River. I'm not saying that in a bad way. There's nothing wrong with it. But, you know, Van Meter, Iowa, you know, me and the wife drove through there back in the summer, you know, stopped in there, and it's like, okay, yeah, it's kind of a nice little town in Iowa. Just kind of like your stereotypical small Iowa town. There's nothing special or spectacular about it. If it weren't for this pterodactyl that flew through there, like at the turn of the century or turn of the 20th century, like, yeah, nobody would even know about it. It's just another random place on the map. And these places are all over the U.S. But like, it's really cool. Roswell, like, yeah, I mean, who would go to Roswell? Right. I mean, if it weren't for, you know, for all the UFO lore behind it. But now you go there, they've embraced the Roswell legacy. And I mean, it's just such a cool place because there's alien murals like painted everywhere. The street lamps in town have alien heads on them. The Dunkin' Donuts in town has like a 25-foot alien holding Dunkin' Donuts sign. It's just cool. There's the International UFO Museum there. It's a really fun place to stop. Got the Chamber of Commerce is just like out in the middle of the desert. They've got these little displays that you can stop and take pictures of. And I think it's really cool when these towns, do embrace this legacy, and it brings visitors in, from all over. I mean, you pull into Roswell, you're going to see car tags with Vermont license plate on them. You know, it's like California, Michigan, just people from all over come there just because of this, supposed UFO crash that happened 70 years ago. I mean, it's a really cool thing.
Yeah. I think it's also important as well, because it's not something that's really caught hold here in the UK, that we celebrate areas where strange things have happened. There's a couple of places. Denver, you've got Deckman Woods in Scotland, where there was a very famous alien UFO encounter that happened at end of the 70s, early 80s. With a forestry worker who had a very odd incident occur to him. And also Rendlesham has also embraced itself, and it's got a little trail. And I think when you talk about some of these places in the US, as you say, you look at how successful the Mothman Festival is. People fly in from abroad for that. Looking at the footage this year, because of, as we're aware, a lot of places had to cancel everything in 2020, 2021. So 2022, a lot of places saw massive upturns in their festivals because people were clearly really thirsty to get back and visit these places. And I think when we're talking about, as you say, quite rightly, Hopkinsville, Van Meter, Point Pleasant, most people, with the greatest of respect, would not go out of their way, or certainly out of state, to visit these places, because unless they've got the greatest restaurant in the state, you ain't pulling anybody in outside of the state capital, really.
Yeah. I mean, that's how Roswell is, because it's, it's a pretty good sized town as far as towns in New Mexico go. But, you know, really, it's a long way from anything. It's a long drive from Albuquerque or Las Cruces or any of the bigger cities. And, if we're being honest, it's not in the prettiest part of the state, the prettier parts of New Mexico. That's White Sands, that's out in the western parts with all the mountains. At Roswell, it's just kind of, sort of where the desert meets the prairie, I guess, just kind of scrubby. And, it's not even like the prettiest place, but man, people just flock to Roswell, and they've got the festival every year, but all the times I've been there have been away from the festival. Me and the wife stayed for a week on the outskirts of Roswell in October, and like I said, man, there's people from all over. Go past the UFO museum, I mean, there's just tons of people like lined up going that museum. And so it's just really cool. And like we're talking about, I mean, I don't know if you could really quantify the type of business Roswell would do without this UFO legacy, but I bet you the town would be a whole lot smaller. There'd be a whole lot less businesses, a whole lot less restaurants and hotels, because, it seems to me that everybody's going there for UFOs.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the other aspect of this, because a lot of these places were industrial towns. Towns usually were built up because there was something there that people could use for as long as it was there. Or you had a lot of industrial businesses running out of there. You look at sort of Point Pleasant and what it was used for after the war, Denver, and its position on the river. There was a lot of heavy industry going on up there, which eventually stopped and places shut down. So for a lot of these little towns and places out of the way, their monsters and their UFOs and their aliens may have saved their town from disappearing off the face of the map. Because the other aspect of this, and this is something that you've delved into over the years as well, is there are countless ghost towns littered across certain states where you can see what happened during the gold and silver rushes of the 19th century Denver, where thousands of people turned up, took everything they could, and within 5 or 10 years, the entire town had near enough collapsed. So, like you say, why would somebody go to Roswell? I mean, how good are their Dunkin' Donuts that you would travel 3 hours to get some?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. And those ghost towns you talk about, I mean, they're literally scattered, I mean, all over the U.S., but you really see it out in the Southwest. I was down in the Big Bend area of Texas. There's the National Park, and it's, you know, right on the Mexican border, out kind of in the desert. But, you can see these, old homes that are just, they're crumbled, you know, they're made out of the stone that are falling down, because there used to be, a mining rush there. And, you know, once that fizzled out, there's just nothing left. And, you know, if it weren't for the national park, probably the whole area would be a ghost town. And, you know, you see it out in Utah. There's all these old little mining towns that, you know, just walk around out on some of the public BLM land out there, and you just see like these old foundations where, you know, there were just like these scattered mining camps and things, and you can still see the rusty tin cans, you know, where they would have their, you know, food supplies. And yeah, it's just like here today, gone tomorrow. And you see that all over the country and traveling around. I mean, I've been to all kinds of towns where, you can tell it's not quite ghost town status yet, you know, but you give it about 10 or 15 more years and there won't even, you know, be anything standing anymore, you know, just because industries dry up, or, you know, like used to be these farming communities, but now it's, you know, like the big mega farms, right? And there's just no need for, you know, the little population center anymore. It's kind of sad in a lot of ways when you see these things, but I guess it's just sort of the circle of life, I guess.
Absolutely. So, obviously, after hitting Mammoth Cave and Hopkinsville so early in your endeavors, Denver, did you kind of hang around that particular area of the country and try and visit any other famous areas? Because obviously, you're not too far away from a few notable states with strange creatures around there. So, was it a case of you kind of tried to do areas of the U.S. at once? You're not sort of flying from Kentucky up to Oregon and then back down to New Mexico, or are you just kind of trying to pass through where you are and basically keep it close and just keep traveling around that particular area?
Yeah, that's sort of what we do. You know, when I was out in Kentucky there, we stayed out there for a few weeks and then sort of, you know, crept our way down through Tennessee and then slowly got down to Florida by the time it started getting real cold. So, you know, while I was in that area, you know, talked about Hopkinsville and Mammoth Caves. Also spent a little time in the land between the lakes, which borders, you know, Kentucky and Tennessee. Mm. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners that are fans of Dogman, you know, they've heard about the tales of the supposed dogmen in the land between the lakes area there. That was a pretty good bit of my trip for unexplained sort of things. And then, you know, obviously, you know, when I'm down in Florida there, there's not a part of the state, I don't think, that doesn't have the skunk ape tail and all of that. So, as I travel along, you know, a lot of times I have an idea in my head, oh, I'm going to be in this place, so I can kind of look around and see if I see any signs of dog men or skunk apes, and you know, and then I'll learn about new things as well as I'm traveling around.
I suppose that's one of the great things about this, Denver, is we can all dive into certain famous cryptids like the skunk ape. I think if you asked anybody about Florida's most famous one, they would say it's definitely the skunk ape. But I think, as you say there, when you're actually in a state, once again, meeting people, going into bookshops, local history societies, that's when you find out just how weird certain places are. So has that surprised you, just how little you actually know about a particular state that you thought you knew a lot about? I mean, obviously you've got in your previous works, you've done local history books, which is often one of the best ways to find out about an area. And it's something that since I've done this show, wherever I go in the UK, I will always try and dig out a local history book or a local legends book, because more often than not, I've never heard of most of them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it seems like everywhere you go in the country, there's the more you dig around, like there's hauntings and your big rash of Bigfoot sightings, or there was a rash of UFO sightings that took place here, and then you know, you can find out a lot of things that you didn't really know that the state had a lot of, like, you know, like when I was traveling through Florida, I learned that I really didn't really know that there were a lot of the old Indian mounds in Florida, but it's actually full of them. A lot of them are still standing. And, you know, I've learned about a lot of supposed giant bones and things that come out of these mounds in Florida. And that was something that I'd always sort of equated more with the Ohio Valley, you know, West Virginia and Ohio and places like that. And, you know, you learn that, you know, there's a lot of that down in Florida too, which kind of surprised me. So, yeah, every place you go, there's just always something to learn, something that you didn't quite expect.
Have you been able to indulge your love of petroglyphs? Because I know you've always had a deep interest in these all over the US, Denver, and I would imagine this has been the perfect example to actually go and see some of these places firsthand, even if you've had trouble finding them.
Yeah, for sure. I mentioned that I'm in Arizona right now, and as me and the wife have traveled across Arizona, it seems like every like big rock pile in the desert, it seems like has a bunch of petroglyphs on it. We were just out in the Tucson area a couple weeks ago. And I mean, there's just tons of petroglyphs out there all over the public lands. I know there's a lot on private lands too. And it's, you can't really get access to that unless you know somebody, but, out in the Tucson area in the national park, the Saguaro, National Park, there's some really good petroglyphs there. And out on the BLM land, tons of petroglyphs. I was even surprised. I mentioned that's down in the Big Bend area in Texas, out in Big Bend National Park. I didn't know this. I had actually been to Big Bend before, and this time I learned that there were some pretty good petroglyphs out on the national park land there. And I was able to see some of those. So I'm always on the lookout for petroglyphs, and in the Southwest, I mean, it's just amazing. You know, like I said, you can always find some on these rock faces out in the middle of the desert. And in fact, when I get off of here with you, me and the wife, we found a trail that's supposed to have some petroglyphs that we were going to go explore later today, actually.
Fabulous. So is it one of those things, as someone with not too much knowledge about Native American tribal lands and their nations, Denver, were certain tribes and nations more attuned to doing petroglyphs, or is this something that seems to apply to all the nations that existed across the continent?
Well, in the Southwest, you know, most of the petroglyphs you see, they're from much earlier culture, so your tribes today would you know, maybe have a cultural relation with some of those tribes, but it seemed to be something that was, you know, mostly taking place, you know, 1,000 years ago.
Mm.
The Mogollon culture, the Membrace, you know, Anasazi, there's a lot of Anasazi petroglyphs in Utah, the Fremont culture. So, you know, a lot of your tribes today, you know, have some connection, but it seems like most of them were, you know, a lot further back. There's really been some amazing petroglyphs, and like out in Utah specifically, that I've seen that really kind of will kind of blow your mind. I saw, you know, some of the ones that I keep coming back to. I saw some on this ranch. It's actually there. It's a private ranch called the McConkey Ranch near Vernal. But they, like for a $5 donation, they'll let you, you know, kind of just walk around on their land, look at all their petroglyphs and everything. And, they just have some amazing ones there. There's just all these humanoid figures. And I mean, they're like 5 feet tall. They're just these huge figures. And I mean, they look Egyptian. I mean, it's crazy. You know, it really, I think, I don't know if you'd call it proof or evidence, but I would at least say it makes you kind of wonder, you know, if indeed there might have been Egyptians or whatever over here, you know, well before Columbus. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard those old stories about the Egyptian artifacts and things like that in the Grand Canyon. And then when you see these petroglyphs like that, it really makes you kind of scratch your head and wonder if there might be something to some of those old stories. But I've also seen some strange petroglyphs out there. I can think of these one. It's like these two, they're like helmets, right? And they're like 40 or 50 feet up on this rock. You wonder how these guys even got up there to carve them. It's, yeah. You know, I would need to set up a bunch of scaffolds or something to get up there to do the work. But I mean, I swear they look like two guys with like welding helmets on. I mean, it's what it looks to me like, a welding helmet. And it's like, what the heck were they trying to say to us there with those? And you know, you see all these others that are, you know, just these strange figures. I mean, they look otherworldly almost, and it's just really puzzling what they were trying to say with some of these petroglyphs you see.
Yeah. I would imagine as well, one of the things that often gets my goat when people talk about this particular subject, wherever you are in the world, if you've got a culture that indulged in cave art or created petroglyphs, wherever they are, Denver, there will often be creatures that stick out like a sore thumb. And often people say, oh, well, it's just a fantasy or a dream. And yet you'll see that they've got coyotes and wolves and bears and everything else that's around there. And then there'll be some giant lizard or a hairy person or something that looks like an alien. When you're going out, have you seen examples of that where they've got the normal animals sort of sketched and etched into rocks? And then you've seen something that you're going, like, as you've said there about these strange helmets, have you seen something that's made you go, well, what's that? What the hell is that doing there?
Yeah, that's actually quite common in a lot of places. I mean, what you'll have this one panel here. It's like, okay, cool. There's, I'm guessing those are antelope, and okay, cool. Look at that. That looks like a bighorn sheep, and you can kind of tell because they'll, you know, the horns will kind of wrap around like a bighorn sheep's one does, or you'll see what are clearly, yeah, those are deer, or, you know, that's, maybe that's a lizard or a snake or something. Yeah. But then like right next to it, it's like, holy crap, what is this, like, fat guy, or, you know, you'll see just this guy with, like, this big trapezoidal, like, huge chest, and it looks like he's got a helmet on with freaking antennas coming out of the helmet. It's like, okay, well, what is that guy? And then you'll see all these spirals, and there's one petroglyph that really blew my mind. This is out in Vernal, out in Utah, at Dinosaur Monument, Dinosaur National Monument, right? people go there for the dinosaurs. There's a big quarry with all these dinosaur bones, all kinds of cool fossil discoveries out there. Really cool place, and that's what most people go for. But they overlook the fact that there's tons of amazing petroglyphs out there. And you know, you can walk around out there on these cliffs and pretty much have the place to yourself, because you know everybody's over at the fossil exhibit. But anyway, I saw this. I just saw these ones out on this cliff. I mean, it just blew my mind. Right? It's like those, like, I don't know, maybe you call them the ant people, like petroglyphs. You know, it looks like they got the little antennas coming out of their head, but then there's others, you know, they look like freaking aliens. I mean, I'm sorry. That's just what they look like. Call me a kook. But the one, you know, like there's this weird looking guy, right? And like, there's this spiral. And, you know, a lot of people think that the spirals, you know, there's all kinds of theories what they represent. Well, you know, whether it's the cosmos or the slow dissemination of esoteric knowledge, there's all kinds of theories. But you know, some people think they represent like portals, or yeah, maybe portals not a good word, but like doorways, you know, to other worlds.
Yeah.
And so there's this, you know, there's like this huge figure. I'm guessing he's about 3 feet tall. And like I said, he's kind of alien looking, and he's holding a portal or, you know, one of those big spirals. And like underneath the spiral, there's like these ant looking figures or whatever, with the, you know, the humanoid figures with like the antennas coming out of their head, but it's upside down. And, you know, I just, that petroglyph just stuck with me. Like, what are they trying to say here? And it just made me think, you know, like the show Stranger Things, right? How they go to the upside down and there's like this kind of world sort of parallel with our own. Is that what they're trying to tell us, that there's these intelligences or beings, you know, maybe in this parallel world with ours? I don't know, but you see these strange petroglyphs, and like I said, they're all over the Southwest, and it just really makes you wonder about a lot of things. I'll say that.
Absolutely. Is there a lot of promotion and protection of these sites now, Denver? Because I would imagine, sadly, that perhaps in the past a lot of these places weren't protected or were just dismissed as kooky nonsense. Whereas, obviously, as our knowledge and our understanding of the world and our history has changed and developed and improved, I think we can now really take on board just how culturally important these sites are. Is there a lot of sort of movement in regards to sort of preserving these places?
Yeah, there really is. And, you know, most, you know, I don't know about most. It's hard to tell, like out on some of these big ranches out west, like how many of these sites might be out there on private land that we don't even know about. Mm-hmm. But as far as these petroglyph sites, you know, out west, it would probably be hard for a lot of your listeners, like in the UK, to understand. But in the western US, once you get west of Texas, most of the land out there is federally owned and would fall under, what our agency is, the Bureau of Land Management. So there's just these vast swaths of land, and so these petroglyphs and things are protected in that sense, that they're, you know, that they're on federal land, you know, they can't be developed or this or that. And you know, a lot of these petroglyph sites that are real popular and easy to access, what they've done now, they've actually set up cameras and game cameras, like the one out in Big Bend. They've actually, the park rangers have put up game cameras, you know, to discourage people from vandalizing them, because unfortunately, a lot of these petroglyph sites have been vandalized. And you know, a lot of the vandalism actually goes back to like the late 1800s and early 1900s. You'll see, I guess, where some cowboy, you know, put his, you know, initials in a date way back when. But there's been a lot of effort these petroglyphs, you know, to keep them from being vandalized. That has really stepped up over the last several years. And, you know, a lot of them, they're out in such remote places. Like it, you know, it might take like I've hiked like 7-8 miles to see some of these things before. So that kind of weeds out the riffraff that would, you know, nobody's like hiking 8 miles to go vandalize something. You know, you're doing it because you got a genuine interest and want to see it. So most of those don't really have cameras and things, but the ones that are easy to get to are protected a little bit better now.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. That's really good to hear. So I think one of the other aspects of your interest, Denver, that some people might be surprised about, I'm not, because obviously I've followed your work for a long time, is that hauntings often crop up. Now, I might have got this wrong, but I'm positive that I've heard you talk about this, so I don't know. Apologies if I've misheard this, but did you have a strange encounter on a late night road once?
On a late night road, I'm trying to think which one we're talking about. Yes. Did this is kind of this is one of those kind of crazy deals, like, you know, you either believe it or you don't. I don't really care. Like, I know I saw a ghost if you don't believe me, whatever. But yeah, I was this was back in Virginia, and this was in the early 2000s, and I was actually around it was in the 3 o'clock hour. I'd say probably between 3:30, 3:45 thereabouts. I was driving into work real early, and just this guy, I mean, I'm doing like 60, probably about 60 miles an hour on Route 29, in this rural stretch of road. And this guy just like materialized in front of my truck. I'm just like, he's like walking diagonally, like right in front of my truck, kind of got his head down, never looks up at me. And like, I just, within an inch of hitting him, you know, I like slam on my brakes, blowing the horn, cussing, and pull over on the shoulder, and he's gone. He just like disappeared. It's just like the damnedest thing that, you know, that ever happened. It was just like so weird. I mean, I'm looking around through all my mirrors. I mean, he's gone.
Yeah.
But it was just so weird. I mean, I could see him clearly. He had like, he looked like something straight out of 1995, you know. He had like a mullet hairstyle.
Yeah.
he had it on like a gray pocket t-shirt, looked like he had a pack of cigarettes in his pocket, and had his shirt sleeves rolled up a little bit, and was wearing faded blue jeans. I mean, yeah, he looked like something straight out of the South in the you know, in the mid-90s, you know. Just it's just crazy. And yeah, I don't know who he was or any really much more than that, but there were no cars anywhere. Yeah, he just like vanished, you know, just like vanished into the night air. I mean, it's just, yeah, that's why I it's one of those things I kind of, you know, really troubled me for a while, but eventually I just kind of, you know, didn't really think about it no more. And then in recent years, I kind of started thinking about it more. And dude, that was a ghost. That's consistent with a lot of stories I've heard from other people, you know, things like that out in the middle of the night, traveling around. You know, it's I don't know. I guess it might even be a little bit similar to some of your vanishing hitchhiker type stories, you know?
Yeah.
You know, obviously, I didn't pick him up, right? But I almost ran him over. But it, still, it's like this apparition that just sort of in the middle of the night out on some deserted section of road that, you know, just sort of appears and vanishes. And, you know, and that's why I don't know. I get a little annoyed with there needs to be skepticism of things, of, you know, of people's accounts, of people's ghost stories or their cryptid sightings. There needs to be skepticism. I get it. But, you know, you got these people out there. They just kind of poo-poo everything. You know, the vanishing hitchhiker is just, I don't know. For some reason, I was reading a Wikipedia article on it, and they're like, skeptic Joe Nickel investigated the vanishing hitchhiker, and he said there's no basis for these claims. I'm like, oh, okay, Joe Nickel said it, so therefore, you know, everybody's full of crap that sees something. You know, I just get kind of annoyed with the people that are just like committed debunker types. You know, they just kind of write off all these kind of vanishing hitchhiker stories. And yeah, I mean, I guess some of it's urban legend, but I think that stuff gets started somewhere, and it's from, you know, people that have experiences like I just told you. I mean, I'm not making, why would I make that up? I mean, you know, I mean, why would I just pretend that that happened? I mean, I'm not getting anything out of it, you know?
It is. It's that is a particularly annoying thing that you will come across, that phenomena is just completely dismissed out of hand. The vanishing hitchhiker, as you refer to there, Denver, is something that I always love these kind of stories because they're very interesting. And I know of several that make a mockery of anybody that says they're not true, because I know of at least two people in the UK who picked people up. And it's not an urban myth. It's not a story. They've both been interviewed by the press. They've both been on television, both in two different parts of the UK, in England. Both had very different things happen to them. Both were so shaken by what happened to them, they reported it to the police because they just couldn't explain what had happened to them. I've seen a report with police officers in South Africa who claimed that they saw a ghost opening their car doors whilst they were driving on a particular stretch of road that's notorious for this alleged phantom hitchhiker in South Africa, Denver. So I think often it's very easy to focus on the ones you can explain away and say, oh, well, it's just an urban myth like Bloody Mary or, you know, or Resurrection Mary and things like that. And when you can put those stories to bed, it's that, oh, well, everything else isn't true. And
yeah.
You know, these people were normal people. They hadn't, as you've just said, they've no reason to lie about what happened to them. They were just normal people going about their everyday business. I mean, one guy even offered his hitchhiker a packet of cigarettes, and it was only when he reached over to offer him one that he realized he wasn't there anymore.
Oh, man. That's crazy. Gosh. Yeah.
So, and that happened, I think that one happened early evening. So you can't even, you know, with the greatest respect, Deborah, and I'm certainly not trying to be dismissive to what you're telling me. I'm sure people have said to you, oh, well, perhaps you were tired. Perhaps you dropped off. You were dreaming. You were imagining it. And yet you still had the wherewithal and reaction to be able to avoid the crash, make sure you didn't crash your truck, and pull over safely and think, what the hell have I just seen?
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, I don't care if anybody believes the story or not, and I've always been hesitant to really share my own stories, like, since I write about this stuff. But, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, it's just, if you don't believe it, I don't really care. I mean, okay, don't believe it. Cool. You know, fine. But there's just so many things like that where you have these committed debunkers, and it doesn't matter what you would give them. They'll demand this for evidence. So you give them that, you know, you give them the evidence that they say they need, then they're just going to move the goalpost. You know, they're just committed to debunking these weird stories. And, you know, they say that they're they won't call themselves debunkers. They'll just call themselves like, I don't know. They'll use terms like objective rationalist or, you know, whatever little buzzword they use, but they're debunkers and they're just not going to believe anything. And they'll, you know, they'll call people liars or, you know, like you said, oh, you just fell asleep and woke up. Like, okay, yeah, I fell asleep driving 60 miles. Yeah, if I would have done that, I would be dead. You know, because I would have crashed into the telephone pole about 50 yards up, you know.
Yeah.
But it's like that, you know, not just with ghost stories, with, you know, with any, you know, whether it's UFO sightings or Bigfoot. I mean, you got, you know, I know guys that they're committed hunters, outdoorsmen. I'm sorry, but, you know, a guy that grew up in the mountains and spends every Saturday out deer hunting, I'm sorry, he's not mistaken a regular old black bear for a Bigfoot. He's just not. It's just not happening. Or you have these, you know, same type of guys that will have a Bigfoot encounter and they won't go into the woods anymore, you know? I mean, so, yeah, you can make fun of them or you can dismiss the phenomenon, but something is going on out there.
Yeah. I mean, I always take those encounters as they're told, Denver, because as you say, you know, you're talking about people whose livelihood depends on their ability to tell the difference between which animal they're going to shoot, you know?
Yeah.
And if you're telling me you've got hunters running around the woods who can't tell the difference between a bear and a deer and a large rabbit, I remember one particular encounter being dismissed as, then you question the sanity of these people. It is remarkable how dismissive they can be. And I think often as well, as we talk about some of these people, there are a lot of these people who are salt of the earth, men and women who live in small towns in small areas in the US. And Canada as well, when we're talking about Bigfoot. And I think people, there is a snobbery sometimes, Denver, when you talk about these certain people, because people just dismiss them as being uneducated or stupid. But I tell you what, if you put a clever person in the wood and tell him to go hunt, I bet he can't do it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, yeah, it would be easy to dismiss And look, I'm sure that there are, especially when black bears, you know, stand up on their hind legs. There's misidentification. I'm not saying that there's not. I'm not suggesting that at all. In fact, I'm kind of in the camp that I think probably 90% of things have a good explanation or reasonable down to earth explanation. But I'm talking about the ones, you know, that are the 10%. And yeah, so sure, there's hikers that, you know, grew up in the city and, you know, maybe only get out a couple times a year to go on a hike or something for some exercise. Yeah, maybe they mistook a black bear for a Bigfoot. But I'm telling you, a guy that's been, you know, a 55-year-old guy that's been, you know, has been out in the woods hunting since he was 11 or 12 years old, he's not making that mistake. So, I mean, if he's telling me, you know, a bipedal ape threw rocks at him, hey, you know, I don't know what the answer is, but I don't have any reason to, you know, to think that, you know, he's just making something up or, well, you just saw a black bear and you know, an acorn fell off a tree and you thought he was throwing a rock or, you know, some of these cockamamie excuses that people come up with, you know.
Or it's somebody running about in a suit and you would suggest that an area where you've got people hunting them, but that is not the best place to go running about in a suit trying to hoax people.
Now, you're not going to live very long.
then we'll find out if it really is a black bear standing up.
Yeah, that would be kind of foolish. I mean, I'm sure it happens, but
oh, of course,
you know,
it will.
I don't think it's the, you know, people just try to give these overarching explanations, or I think sometimes the debunkers' explanations are far more ridiculous sometimes than just a bipedal ape in the woods, right? I mean, I just don't know. You know, there's just such a rush to dismiss a lot of this weird stuff rather than just, you know, and I'm not saying you got to accept it. I'm just saying sort of is what it is. We don't know what's going on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, as you've been traveling, as we touched on about your personal experience there, Denver, have you gone out looking for some other haunted locations then? Because I know, I think when you were up in Iowa, did you not visit one of the most famous haunted bridges in that state?
Yeah, when I was in Iowa, me and the wife did the Bridges of Madison County tour, and you know, before everybody starts busting my balls, she got me to agree to this because one of those bridges from that movie, the filming locations, it's allegedly haunted. So I'm like, all right, cool. I mean, I would have went anyway, even if it's, you know, she does plenty of stuff with me. So yeah. I guess I can suck it up and, you know, go on like this chick flick tour, you know, so it's fine. But yeah, one of the bridges it's allegedly haunted. Supposedly there was, and you know, you never know how much of the backstory of these things that you can believe, right? I mean, like, and that's the thing with these haunted places. I mean, people will see apparitions or have things happen. You know, you'll have the cold spots or, you know, or hear like these phantom voices. And you'll have that at places, even if the backstory is sometimes demonstrably false. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
A lot of places you can tell, okay, like, no, if a murder happened here, like, there's no record of it. There's no police report. There's no, okay. And you know, you can actually demonstrate that a lot, but that still doesn't discount the fact that people have these strange encounters in some of these places. And I think that this bridge is sort of the same way. I'm not sure. I think supposedly there was like a prisoner that escaped from the local jail, and he sort of like got trapped inside the bridge there. And I can't remember if they like shot him or, and he like disappeared, something like that. Anyway, it's just some backstory that I'm not sure I really buy, but at the same time, there are paranormal investigators have been out there and found cold spots, EMF spikes, and people have heard voices. You get a lot of the, eyewitnesses that have seen apparitions there. Reports of like a weird mist inside the bridge and that sort of thing. So I didn't really experience anything weird myself. I wouldn't really conduct in any sort of investigation. I was more or less just kind of doing, like I said earlier, like kind of like to put my boots on the ground and these sort of places. But yeah, it's kind of one of those things where one of the chick flicky things that my wife likes sort of come together with something I liked, and it ended up being a pretty cool day.
Brilliant. And it's also a bit of history, and it's somewhere that's known outside of the States as well, obviously primarily because of the film and the book Denver, but it's, you know, and once again, it's an area's history, isn't it, regardless?
Yeah, it is. And it's, you know, it's kind of a cool little area in Iowa. You know, people, at least people on the East Coast, and I would imagine on the West Coast, people kind of bag on Iowa, you know, but I love it. It's a lot cooler place than you'd really think. You think of just, you know, just boring cornfield, but there's a lot of neat little places in Iowa. And this this bridge tour, I don't remember how many bridges there are. We didn't go to every single one, but we went to like five, I think, and it just kind of spans maybe like a 30-mile area, just some of the most beautiful farmland and some, you know, nice wooded areas, just a real pretty part of the country. And and in the closest town there, Winterset, from it, you know, you've also got like the John Wayne Museum. That's where he was born, so there's like a little tribute to John Wayne there. And you know, the town is just sort of what you picture with you know, your small town Midwestern America type thing. So it's a lot of fun.
So as you're planning and traveling around, then Denver, Is there anywhere you have yet to visit that you desperately want to go, even if it's just once again to say, yes, I've been there, that you've never had an opportunity to visit as yet?
Yeah, so there's a few places. I guess the one that I really, really, really am looking forward to trying to get to, I want to get to Mount Shasta out in California. I mentioned earlier, me and the wife will be in California a couple weeks, and we'll probably be in California for about 4 months, maybe a little bit longer than that, you know, just kind of slowly going up the coast and all over the state. And so I'm really, I really got my sights set on Mount Shasta because of, I mean, you want to talk about weirdness. I mean, whether it's, whether it's Bigfoot, UFOs, I mean, Lemurians for
I was going to say, you're going looking for the treasure, Denver. That's why.
Yeah. I'm going to try to hook up with the Lemurian Fellowship out. No, but there's just all these weird, you know, things, you know, with Mount Shasta. And I just really want to get out there and, you know, kind of experience it for myself. I mean, whether I'll figure anything out or not, that remains to be seen. But like I said, I just really want to put my boots on the ground there and, you know, just check it all out real good. So I'm really, really excited about that.
Yeah. I mean, this is the other aspect of all this as well, then, but regardless of the fact that you love mysteries and weirdness and cryptids and ghosts, you're going to some of the most beautiful scenery the country has to offer you. So regardless of hunting for weird things, you are drinking in some of the most breathtaking parts of America.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's really, that's the best part of it to me because, you know, long before I got into cryptid creatures or ghosts, I mean, since I was a young man, I mean, you know, preteen, I've always really been into nature and the outdoors. So,
yeah.
I mean, I get to spend so much time in these, just these amazing places and these places that are off the beaten path. I mean, our national parks, they're great and I love them, but, you know, sometimes they're a little bit crowded and stuff. So there's all these national forests that see a lot less traffic. There's the Bureau of Land Management land that sees even less. And I just get to see these amazing places and out in, the places in Arizona and out in Big Bend in Texas at night. I mean, the stars are so bright that I can't even describe it to you. You know, you just got to see it for yourself. It's just amazing to be able to experience that.
Yeah. Even something as simple as looking at the night sky, depending where you are, Denver, and where you're from. I think when you go somewhere where it's pitch black, and you can actually look up and just see how many stars you can really see at night because you're not suffering from light pollution.
Yeah.
It's breathtaking the first chance you get to experience something like that.
It is. And you know, most people don't get to experience that. I mean, out in these places, there's a lot of these places out west, they call them dark sky communities where, it's like actual like town or county ordinances that you have to shut off your outdoor lights by, let's say, like 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I mean, oh my God, the stars are just so amazing. You know, if you go out and like, say you just get up at like 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning and, you know, walk out, let your eyes adjust, you know, and then you look up at the sky. I mean, it sounds kind of flaky, I guess, but it's almost like a religious experience to me. It's like, you just like, I don't know, you just kind of just see how vast and amazing the, you know, the universe is. And in these places that, I mean, you can like see the Milky Way with your own eyes, you know, without any kind of manipulation of the camera and see it clear. Like it's just amazing. And sadly, most people don't get to experience that because like you're talking about the light pollution and even, even in Virginia, where I lived, and I was kind of out in the country a little bit, and you're far away from the big cities, but still all that pollution kind of carries. You really got to kind of get way, 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 way out in the middle of nowhere, you know, like out west, so you can really see those stars so clear. And it's a spectacular experience.
Absolutely. It's something that I've experienced a couple of times, usually abroad. I remember being in Greece and looking at the night sky once on a beach, and it was just, it's like you just said, Denver, it's amazing just how much you can actually see with your naked eye.
Yeah. I think the first time I experienced that, I was in Peru. Mm. And it was kind of cool in Peru, you know, as in the Amazon. And, you know, of course, you got to get to a place where you can kind of see through the canopy, like out along the river.
Yeah.
But it was cool there because, you know, you're looking at the stars and you're in the southern hemisphere. So that was they you know what I'm saying? They're like kind of backwards, and maybe not backwards, but you're seeing a different sky, you know, than you see, you know, up here where I live. So, yeah, I really encourage people. These are maybe you've never thought about it before, but these are things you need to put on your bucket list. You know, seeing the stars as they're meant to be seen, things like that is something you should really try to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think that's a beautiful moment, Denver, to release you back into your travels. So, my friend, where can everybody follow your work and get hold of a copy of your latest book and your other work and anything else you've got coming out recently?
Yeah, the main thing for my books, unfortunately, I just send people to Amazon. It's just easier to let Amazon deal with it. So, just go to Amazon, look up Denver Michaels on Amazon. All my books are there. If you want to follow along with what I'm up to, I'm on Facebook and Twitter. And also go to my website, denvermichaels.net. There's links to all my books. There's a link to my YouTube channel. And also I post one or two articles a week, you know, covering all sorts of different things, from my travels to weird, unexplained, this or that. So, follow along there.
Absolutely. You're one of the most prolific bloggers and YouTubers out there. You're always sharing your experiences with everybody. So I recommend anybody who wants to see what you're up to and where you've been and get jealous like I do, Denver, to check those out. And I'll put links to everything in the show notes. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a long time coming having you back. I certainly promise you it will not be as long next time, Denver. It's been a real pleasure to finally catch up with you again, my friend. You take care.
Yeah, it's good catching up. Thanks, buddy. We'll be right back.